You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that likes to bring the news before it becomes news, because that's what we do best, as well as insight and analysis on all the topics you're talking about in the game. I'm Ian McGarvey, and with me as always is our transfer guru, Duncan Castles. Today is Monday's pod. We've got big news to start with Liverpool. We'll be going on to talk about Mario Mandzukic, Man United. Of course, where would it be without Valerie, our old friend VAR, and a bit of Manchester United, as well as heroes and villains. First of all, though, those of you listening to Friday's pod will remember our German colleague, Raffi Honigstein, telling us a bit more about Timo Werner, who is a target for both Manchester United and Liverpool in the January window, but it may be the summer before he actually makes the move. Now, Raffi told us that it was widely believed the player has a rescission clause in his contract, though no one as yet knows what it is. But what we can tell you on the transfer window today is that Liverpool have begun the process of formal negotiations with RB Leipzig for the player's transfer. We understand that contact has been made and indeed is ongoing between Liverpool and the German Bundesliga side, and that Werner himself is keen for a move to Anfield, where, of course, he would link up with countryman Jurgen Klopp. Now, interestingly, Duncan, one of the things that we've also been told with regards to potential deal, Raffi, remember, told us on Friday that Werner was extremely disappointed that he's moved to Bayern Munich, effectively broke down and completely disappeared into the ether last summer, and has been quite unhappy at Leipzig since. Well, Liverpool are trying to make that a bit better for both the player and his club, because it has been suggested that they would buy the player in the January window, and then he would be loaned back to RB Leipzig for the remainder of the Bundesliga season, allowing Leipzig, obviously, to get good 5 months out of the player. Allows the player to put the disappointment of the Munich transfer disintegrating behind him, gives him obviously impetus and motivation. Duncan, this is something we've seen with Liverpool before, and you've been very praiseworthy of the way that they conduct transfers these days in terms of both their planning and execution.
Yes, look, Liverpool are extremely focused in the players they pursue. You have their analytics department using statistical methods to sift down to a cohort of players they think are potential Liverpool signings, have the qualities required in terms of goal production. And by goal production, I don't simply mean scoring goals or assisting goals. It's they actually focus on every pass a player makes during a game to see whether that increases the likelihood of a goal being scored or decreases the likelihood of a goal being scored. And that's one of the fundamental analytical elements that they use to secure a group of players who their scouts then do further work on in a more traditional manner to decide whether they're the right signings. They're also very focused on players who they can actually secure. So they tend to go to clubs like Leipzig, like Roma, where they know that if they meet a certain price, that club will sell to them, as opposed to targeting players at clubs who are on the same tier as them in European competition who are likely to outright refuse to sell the player. As you say, they've taken this a similar type of approach to this before with Naby Keita, identifying him as the midfielder they wanted to add creativity to the central area of the team, and setting a deal up with Leipzig basically a year in advance, which was in Keita's case dependent on where Leipzig finished in the Bundesliga season, but was for a very substantial amount of money, and came with an element of risk because, of course, if you agree to that deal in advance, you have the risk of the player being injured during the season in which you're waiting for him to come. Werner, as Rafi explained on the podcast, on Friday's podcast, and I'd recommend the listeners to go back and listen to it again. He feels Werner would be a better fit to Liverpool's system than Manchester United's. He explained that Werner's pretty similar to Rashford and Martial in being a striker who needs a reference point and prefers to play off other forwards, whereas he could see him fitting into Liverpool's sort of very mobile strike force as a natural replacement for one of the individuals they have in there, Sadio Mane, Roberto Firmino, or Mohamed Salah at present. So you have to say that if Liverpool have already begun discussions with Leipzig to secure this player, and they can offer a deal in which they allow the player to remain with Leipzig for the remainder of the season, and Leipzig are guaranteed their cash in January, that they would have a significant advantage over Manchester United, who are on record as saying that they want to bring new forwards in January to try and repair the damage that's been caused by the early start to the season, and who of course cannot offer anything like as attractive a football prospect as Liverpool can. You know, the choice for the player would be go to a team who are struggling even to get into the places for a Europa League qualification, never mind Champions League qualification, who haven't been there this year, or go to the current European champions who are 6 points clear in the Premier League and very much looking like they can end that 30-year wait to win an English title for the first time in those three decades. So, as well as the attraction of working for Jurgen Klopp, I think if you were to go to any high-level footballer at present and say to them your choice is to play for Jurgen Klopp, who has been successful in German football and has taken Liverpool to European Cup and top of the Premier League, or you play for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, whose history pre-Manchester United is getting Cardiff City relegated and some degree of success in Norway, that would be a very easy choice for any player, I think, at that level of football across Europe.
And interestingly, Duncan, in the discussions that I had regarding this progress in terms of Liverpool's interest in Timo Werner from RB Leipzig, it was mentioned to me that Klopp, and I think we did discuss this after the Champions League win, Klopp was determined to keep faith with the team and the squad that he had because he felt they got so close to winning the Premier League title last season. They did go on to win the Champions League final, massive thing for them to get that first trophy as a team as well. And but now he realises that the lack of investment in the summer didn't maybe freshen the squad up in a way that perhaps would have been beneficial. And while he's very happy and extremely trustworthy in terms of the players he has and the relationship he has with them, that it may be the right time to bring a player like Werner in who, if there's an injury, a suspension, or indeed just a little bit of tiredness, never mind burnout, in the Firmino, Salah, Mane, and the attacking three, then he would be able to bring in a player of similar, if not same, talent and status to replace one of them and actually be able to do something he's not been able to do before, and that's rotate and give the players a rest in order that everyone's always going to be at the peak of fitness, the peak of sharpness in terms of coming back into play. And Werner can play across all three positions, though he does prefer to play, as you said, coming in from the flank. Now, given how important, you know, the three front players are to Liverpool and the way they play, I think Shaqiri was brought in to potentially be someone who could take one of those spaces, but clearly his mobility and speed are not up to it. He's certainly got a good eye for a pass, but he can't keep pace with the kind of attacking influence that Liverpool had. So Shaqiri's obviously finding himself on the bench. He's unhappy. It wouldn't surprise me if there was interest in Shaqiri in January, and indeed if he left the club in the next 7 or 8 months anyway. Now, of course, that would free up a space for Werner in the squad. Not that, of course, he would have any difficulty finding a place. But my point being that Liverpool would simply go from strength to strength if Werner was to be secured, whether it be in January or indeed, as has been mooted, being loaned back to RB Leipzig in January and then coming for pre-season training and a proper induction into Liverpool's team next summer.
Well, there's two elements here. Liverpool have had remarkable success in keeping those players, Salah, Firmino, Mane in particular, on the pitch through a period in which there's been huge demands on all of them, both at club level and international level. And we've discussed a little bit about this in the podcast and the way that Klopp's gone from having lots of injuries when he first came into Liverpool to having very few injuries and a team that is extremely dynamic on the field. But you always run the risk, as you say, if you only have three players for those three positions, that one of them eventually does come down with a significant soft tissue injury and is left out of the side for a while. Or you have that risk that any player has of being injured by an opponent or and having a ligament damaged in a contact injury. As it stands, the options for Jurgen Klopp are Shaqiri, who, as you say, he seems to have lost faith in and who certainly isn't a like-for-like replacement for those three, or Divo Origi, who, again, is not a like-for-like replacement, has been valuable to him, did score a lot of important goals last season. But by the same token, you saw the way he came in against Manchester United when Salah was out for a brief period and had a very poor game against United, and I think it's fair to argue was responsible for Liverpool not being as fluid in attack as you normally expect them to be. The other element of this is we know that Liverpool were pursuing a replacement striker of a similar type in the last transfer window. We know that there was contact made with Nicola Pepe's agent to sound him out about the possibility of coming to Liverpool. There was no bid made to Lille, but the understanding of both Pepe's representatives and Lille was that Liverpool were pursuing this in case they needed to buy a replacement. And the in case that they were worried about was that a very significant offer came in for Mohamed Salah, which Salah chose to pursue. And then a decision would have to be made over whether they allow the player to go cash in with a huge profit on transfer fees, which is something that they've clearly done in the past with someone like Philippe Coutinho. And bring in a player who they believed could achieve the same in that area. So when you see them looking for Werner, I think you have to have a consideration that this could be also thought of as Liverpool on the possibility that Salah might push for that move again this summer, that one of the very affluent clubs in European football put down an offer that attracts them, and therefore they're having the replacement set up in advance. So they could win either way. You bring Werner in at a defined release clause and have him as a fourth member of that to interchange with that triumvirate if Salah and Mane stay, or you have a ready-made replacement if one of them leaves in the summer. So again, it's kind of intelligent. It's the way clubs should be operating, where you expect clubs at the top of the European and English game to operate, is examine the future and use your resources to have options set up far in advance when you need to get them in. And, you know, contrast that with Manchester United, who get 2 weeks or 2 months into first season with their new manager in place and start talking publicly about how they need to get a top-level striker in the January window, because they've realised that they don't have enough bodies, having followed a particular strategy in the summer that they elected to follow, which was to sell their leading scorer over the previous two seasons and change the style of play. The contrast there is just self-evident.
Well, on that theme, Duncan, perhaps Jerdan Shaqiri for Manchester United is a good shout. After all, he does have the X factor. And that's what Edward Ward obviously has said he covets in his signings. So, Jerdan, get yourself down the M62, son. There might be a place for you at Old Trafford. I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you guys who are listening. You know it's your questions answered on Wednesday's pod. So please get in touch, give us your questions. Liverpool fans, what do you think? Do you think Timo Werner would be a good fit for your team? Or do you think it might upset the current front three if they were had to be challenged by a young buck who scores lots of goals and has got pace to burn? Similarly, for those of you, and I'm sure you were all watching the 2-1 victory over Spurs last Sunday, what about Liverpool without Matip? Because I thought Lovren was poor and cost you chances, etc., etc. You know, how are you going to solve that problem in central defence? Is it going to be Joe Gomez? Get in touch. Let us know. As you know, we'd love to get your questions and we'd love to give you answers as best we can. From one striker, Duncan, to another, and you have some interesting news on the wandering Croatian Mario Mandzukic, who is someone who has been wanted by Manchester United, both in the summer and indeed in the next window, potentially. But an offer, maybe out of left field, but certainly one he would consider. Is that correct?
Yeah, so Mario Mandzukic is very much on the transfer market. As you said, in the summer, there was a possibility he would move to Manchester United. That was as part of a complex deal in which Manchester United offered Romelu Lukaku to Juventus when they felt Internazionale were not going to meet their asking price for Lukaku, and they wanted to get another potential buyer involved as a way of offloading Lukaku from their wage bill. So the deal proposed was Lukaku to Juventus, Dybala to Manchester United, and Juventus said, we will do that deal if you take Mario Mandzukic off our hands as well, which United considered. As we reported on the podcast at the time, it fell through over financial terms for Dybala, and eventually Lukaku was sold to Inter instead. Mandzukic since then has not played a game for Juventus at all this season, and has even been left out completely unregistered for their Champions League squad. So the new coach, Maurizio Sarri, made a decision in terms of his forward players and his preference when Dybala decided he wanted to remain in Italy, and the attempts to move him to Manchester United and Tottenham Hotspur in particular fell through. Sarri's decision was, I want to use Dybala as one of my forward options, and Mandzukic can be left on the side. So you've had these discussions that Mandzukic could be an option for Manchester United in January. I think it's pretty clear why that's the case, because Juventus are prepared to sell. He currently, I can tell you, has an offer from Qatar to move to the league leaders in the Qatar Stars League, Duhail. And that offer would see him earn in the region of €7.5 million net per season. Interestingly, €2 million of that salary would be subsidised by Juventus, which gives you an indication of how keen they are to get Mandzukic, who has a history of being on top of a very talented striker who scored goals everywhere he's been, of being a very difficult individual to manage and not the kind of player you want to have sat on the bench and complaining in the training ground about his lack of opportunities. So you have an option there for Mandzukic. If Manchester United are to decide to go down that line because he's available, I think it tells you that it's going to be a costly deal to do. Obviously, in this case, they have an advantage and they can offer the player continued prominence in European football, going to a major club, playing in a new league. But on the other hand, there is big money on offer for him to go to Qatar, which United will have to compete with if they want to try and secure him in January.
And of course, the offer from a particular club is managed by someone who's familiar to all of us, Duncan, Rui Faria.
Indeed, yes. So Rui Faria, in his first full season in Qatar, has taken De Gea to the top of the division, already won the Emir Cup in the half season he was with the club last year, selected for that job by the Emir of Qatar, who is an extremely influential figure in European and world football, as the man who owns Paris Saint-Germain and the man who sanctioned the two most expensive transfers in the history of the game. And Faria, as well, on top of that impressive start in Qatar, which I think people who have followed his career as an assistant to Jose Mourinho at an array of top clubs will not be surprised about, has been pursued by a number of Premier League clubs before he went there, was offered the job at Aston Villa and turned that down, albeit they were still in the Championship then, was approached by Southampton, was wanted by Monaco to take over there. Other offers from France, has had offers on a repeated basis in Portuguese football. And I think down the line, I would expect to see him coaching in the Premier League, such are his abilities and the degree of interest there is in his services from English clubs.
Well, we're getting towards Halloween, Duncan, and also November the 5th. And of course, November international breaks coming up, generally regarded as the graveyard for struggling managers in the Premier League. The November international break, because of course it's the last one before the January window. Do you trust your current coach to invest your cash in the January window and get you out of trouble, or indeed improve your position in the Premier League? I just wonder if there's a couple of clubs that may interest Rui Faria, although in saying that, I think Rui's demonstrated already that he is someone who is very, very thoughtful, considered, and makes intelligent decisions about his career long term, rather than a coach. And there are many of them who simply jump into a job at the sight of a lucrative salary that's being put in front of them.
Yeah, look, I think that's very much the case with Faria. Having won the Champions League twice, won, I think it's 20 major trophies during his career as a key assistant to Mourinho, who was fundamental in the way the teams were managed and in the way the teams were trained in particular. His consideration is, when I start coaching in European club football, I want to coach somewhere where I can be successful. So he's seen how difficult it can be at certain clubs and how important the support and the quality of players available to you are in terms of meeting the expectations of the owners, meeting the expectation of the supporters, and has an awareness that first appointment can have a very big influence on your future career. So the proposal has to be right. Obviously, when someone goes to coach in Qatar and are hand picked by the Emir of Qatar, one of the richest people in the world, they will be well rewarded for their work there, which means that on top of having to convince someone like Faria that the position you're offering him is a good one to come to, you also have to take on the fact that he has a well-paid contract in Qatar, and it would be expensive to achieve his release from that. So I think that's going to be the important element for Premier League clubs pursuing them. I mean, other clubs that have looked at him, he was listed for the Arsenal job before Unai Emery was appointed. Newcastle made an approach via a third party for him. When Rafa Benitez, it became clear that Rafa Benitez was going to leave. So you see the calibre of clubs involved there. I don't think there are many comparable figures in world football at the moment in terms of someone who's had such a long career and successful career as an assistant, and therefore has a huge degree of experience in the job and a track record of success. And then you have this opportunity to see how he will perform when stepping up to the manager's role. And from what the evidence in Qatar is, that that jump to the manager's role has been one he's taken very well, because he wins the first trophy he had a proper opportunity to win, and is top of the league in a team that is not as well resourced and doesn't have as strong a squad as, for example, Al Sadd, the current Qatari champions, who are managed at present by another very famous figure in world football, Xavi.
Indeed they are, and Xavi has been there, I think, almost 3 years now, so clearly he enjoys what he's doing there. And again, someone I think we'll be looking out for, Duncan, just like Rui, who will at some point come back to Europe and manage a big club as well.
Well, Graham Hunter's excellent film about Barcelona had a very prominent role with Xavi talking about tactics in an interesting and compelling fashion, and the suggestion that he might well be a future Barcelona coach. He has been there in Qatar for a while. He was a player up until the end of last season, and this is his first campaign as the manager of Al Sadd.
Now, it was a very eventful weekend in the Premier League. I'm sure you'll all agree. Started off with a scintillating and record-equaling 9-0 win for Brendan Rodgers, Leicester City against Southampton on Friday night, followed by what can only be described as another defining weekend for football's new technology. After admitting mistakes in previous matches, and remember, we're 10 games in, people. It seemed like those who are in control, if indeed VAR has any control whatsoever, maybe VAR is controlling the PGMOL. We're not sure anymore. it could be the case. It's like, I don't know, it's like the Terminator, isn't it, where the machines overtake the human beings, artificial intelligence rules. So at the risk of sounding like a broken record, because we don't like that, Valerie, especially Amy Winehouse's version, is one that I would certainly listen to again and again. Duncan, I mean, how do we even make sense of some of the decisions over the weekend, because they seemed nonsensical? Personally, I feel now that we're in a position where that the people who have invested so heavily in VAR are so hell-bent and desperate to justify it that they are effectively not allowing the referees to contradict VAR. Now, you may not share that point of view, but I know you saw that what everyone saw at the weekend, and you were just, I don't know, were you befuddled by it?
Look, I'm not surprised, because we've said on the podcast from the very start that VAR was a bad idea and predicted a lot of the problems we'd have with it. So another weekend of errors is completely expected. The element that did catch me unawares was, it seems to me that the Premier League has gone back on its policy that it brought VAR in with, which was minimum intervention, a high bar for any decision to be overruled, which has caused a lot of controversy in itself, and suddenly got itself into a position where it was turning over things that were absolutely not clear and obvious errors. The Arsenal's what would have been winning goal against Crystal Palace, where was the foul that was used to chalk off Arsenal's goal? If anything, watching the replay that was poured over by the VAR before deciding the referee had got it wrong in the field, Gary Cahill was fouling the Arsenal player who I would presume was adjudged to have fouled in the build-up to the goal. Definitely not clear and obvious. You've got the penalty that was given to Manchester United when Daniel James essentially fell into Ben Godfrey's body, which even Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said he did not think that should have been overruled and it was wrong, it shouldn't have been a penalty, and complained about the length of time it took to get to that decision. And remember, not only are you giving a penalty there, you're giving a yellow card to the defender in question, which obviously affects the way he plays for the rest of the game. The other penalty Manchester United got was marginal, probably just about justified under the new rules in terms of unnatural position of the arm, but the player had his back to the shot. So again, clear and obvious error. I'm not sure it was a clear and obvious error. You have the Manchester City Aston Villa game where we had a delay of over 2 minutes while VAR poured over a goal in fine detail, which was given onside correctly, in my view, by the linesman and by the referee, and came to the same conclusion as the linesman and the referee in the end. But if it takes 2.5 minutes to review, there clearly isn't a clear and obvious error to be checked there. As you say, we've talked about this in detail. If you want to go through the very many problems of VAR, refer people back to previous podcasts, to the piece I did for the Daily Record, I think almost a year ago now. There isn't a solution to this. I hear people saying, oh, it needs to bed in. They need to alter the way they're applying the system. I think this weekend has showed us that when you alter the way you're applying the system, because if they haven't altered the way they applied the system over the weekend, then it's even more of a travesty what happened, because the VARs clearly weren't implementing the regulations or the guidance that the Premier League started the season with properly this weekend. But assuming they did change it, what it shows you is even when you change it, you get problems. There isn't a perfect implementation of this. It will always be controversial. The game would be better off without it.
Duncan, as part of my research, and I know you're the same in terms of our diligence with regards to making sure we're up to date with everything that's going on, not just in the game in the UK, but also in Europe and worldwide. I do try to watch a bit of highlights and, you know, news from places like the Bundesliga and even MLS. And every time there's a VAR decision, the referee goes to the screen at the side of the pitch and looks at it for himself. Not once has a referee in the English Premier League looked at the monitor, despite it being there, looking sad and lonely because no one ever consults him. No one ever goes to say hello. No one sends him flowers. I mean, why is this? This is ridiculous. Surely, if the referee does have the ability to at least have a debate with the video assistant referee, then they must use the monitor to do so, rather than just simply taking it as read that someone in a truck, you know, near Heathrow has got it right and I've got it wrong, even though I'm 3 yards away from it.
Well, look, I have sympathy with the Premier League's decision or PGMOL's decision to try and avoid using the monitors at all cost, because the calculation was that it wastes time, it breaks up the flow of the match, and that's correct. So I have a sympathy why they introduced that, and I also have sympathy why they wanted to use the high bar criteria, because...
Okay, yeah. Sorry, Duncan, I'm going to interrupt you there because I want to ask you, I think this is an important question that our listeners will be asking as well. Yes, it does hold up the game, but why doesn't the referee immediately go to the monitor and watch what VAR are then looking at as they look at it and talk to him in his ear? Because he can see what they're seeing if he goes to the monitor. Therefore, there's no further hold up because he's only watching what they're watching at the same time.
A lot of these checks are done in the background. So I suppose you could do that with the goal check because he is told to hold up play while a goal is being checked. So in those instances, yeah, the argument, you do have a good argument. You could allow the referee to go to the screen and watch while they're going through the goal check. And that would probably only have a minimal hold up in play in terms of the time it takes them to get to the monitor, get away from the monitor after that's finished. But if you do it in other circumstances when play is going on, so when you're correcting a decision on a foul or other elements of play that VAR monitors, then it is going to have a huge impact on play. And as I say, I have sympathy with the attempted implementation, which is to try and keep the game as fluid as possible and try and remain with the referee's decision on the field as much as possible. But again, this just highlights that it's a system you can't implement properly. You will always get controversy. Because you can go down that route of let's try and keep it as fluid as possible. And the response is, oh, but you've got to let the referee make a decision in the really controversial ones. So get him to go to the screen. And then so the argument is, okay, well, we let him go to the screen on the really controversial ones. Who decides what the really controversial ones are? When do you have them going to the screen? How much time do you allow them to go to the screen? Whatever way you run the system, you get a problem. And the controversy will be there regardless of the implementation because the majority of the key rules in football are subjective. And just allowing a person to have another view doesn't change the fact they're subjective. Or allowing three people to debate over the decision while watching video doesn't change the fact they're subjective. Obviously, with VAR, you get more decisions right. But as we've said before, even on FIFA's own statistics, and these are pretty biased statistics, the increase in correct decisions in the areas in which VAR overlooks on FIFA's own statistics is only 4%. So is it worth for a marginal gain in terms of getting correct decisions, having all the controversy and all the problems it causes, all the cost it causes? I don't think it is. I always thought that was the case. Nothing I've seen watching VAR being implemented has suggested to me I was wrong about that initial conclusion. And I don't see a solution.
One of the huge things that still remains a problem with VAR, of course, is the fact that the crowd inside the stadium, including the coaches, it should be said, are kept in the dark while these... instances are being analysed by the VAR, as well as the decisions being made. Now, Duncan, the precursors, or at least the trailblazers, if you like, for VAR, are in cricket, rugby union, and even the NFL. And in all three cases, the big screens inside the stadium see what the VAR, or let's just say the televised umpire, because we have to go across all three here, not just what they're looking at, but what they hear, what they're saying. And therefore, mm-hmm. they feel involved in the decision. And it does add, I've been at NFL, I've been at cricket, I've been at rugby, where these things have intervened. And you feel like you're part of the drama as the crowd. You're not being excluded from it. You're part of the decision-making process because at least you can see for yourself what it is they're actually analysing. But huge complaints still. And I'm not out to do, you know, public relations work for Valerie. But if I were to, I would say this is one easy change you could make, and that is to put it on screen with the volume up as well. And then you have the referee with a microphone, like it happens in NFL, like it happens in rugby union as well, turn on his mic and explain to everyone in the stadium why the decision was made, overturned, whatever, and what the decision is now. At the moment, all we get, and it's a classic, isn't it? It's like the old school pictures in newspapers of managers when they're talking about transfers, pictured on the telephone to an agent or a player. Instead, we get the referees holding the earpiece to their ear, waiting intently for VAR to make a decision. And then all they do is point and say, right, it's a penalty, or it's not a penalty, it's a corner, not a foul, or whatever. I feel like if they just, if they wanted to make something right about it, that would be a very easy way to do it.
Look, I have a huge amount of sympathy for the people in the stadium who are placed in that position and they don't understand what's going on. I also, people watching on TV, because they don't have the audio to understand the discussion. But, you know, let's do a thought experiment of what happens if you turn on the audio and you show the video. Football has a long history of not allowing referees to explain their decisions, and that's been it's a considered history in terms of not dragging referees into media debates after every match and undermining them by allowing them to go on record. And, you know, if you allow referees to be interrogated by the media after every game, referees are going to make errors of judgment in what they say and they'll be held against them. Football also avoids showing replays of controversial incidents, the reasoning being that that could cause crowd problems. And that's, again, it's a long-standing element of the process. So, you know, you turn on the audio during a match and you're risking both of those things straight away. You're putting the referees' discussions of whether it was a foul or not, and a lot of these are going to be marginal discussions, and they're not going to be able to avoid making it clear that it's a marginal discussion where they have to come to a decision one way or another at the end. That's going to be on record. So we're going to have, he gave a penalty, but he wasn't really sure about the penalty, and he had to be convinced to give it. When you get these marginal decisions.
But Duncan, excuse me for interrupting, that's not what happens in those other sports I mentioned. The referee says, or at least the televised umpire says, original decision on the field was. Then they go to the analysis, mm-hmm. and they do the rock and roll camera, whether it's this or that, such as in cricket, or in TMO and rugby union, as we saw in the semi-finals over last weekend as well. So the referee makes no point of discussing his decision at any point during that part of the process. He then takes instruction on the basis of what the video referee has seen, and then he gives his verdict, and then they say, stick with the original decision or change your decision to this. And all he does is explain. So in the case of the goal that wasn't given for Arsenal, he'll say, red 16, Callum Chambers, adjudged to have fouled Gary Cahill in the build-up to the goal. The decision is no goal. That's all he says. So there's nothing that can be seen as incendiary or provocative from the referee's point of view. He's simply reporting what the discussion that's happened with the video referee.
Well, that's a different argument then, because you're not putting the audio of the full discussion, making it available to the fans, which is what you're proposing would be a better answer.
I'm proposing that they do it the same as the examples in cricket and rugby, whereby you hear the video referee's audio. That's all. Yeah. There's no discussion with the on-field referee. They just state what the original decision was and why, if they even do that. And then they're told, after analysis, this is what is the case. You can stick with your original decision, or we'd suggest, or you must revise that to this, and this is the reason why. In this case, you know, Arsenal 16 fouls Palace, I don't know if Kale's 4, therefore no goal.
Well, then you take away the element of the VAR being able to discuss with the referee, because the referee can't allow his opinion to be stated and the discussion to take place, because the crowd would be able to hear it. You're also showing the video. And once you show the video to the crowd, which is going to be, in most cases, 90% home biased, you have a crowd watching the video, putting pressure on the referee over the decision. And if you have the audio as well, you add that element of the pressure. So the video referee says, I think it's a foul against the home team for these reasons and therefore not a goal. How's the crowd going to respond? We know that this is very straightforward scientific evidence, well demonstrated, of a home crowd effect on referees' decision as it is. So you take it away from that effect in the moment, which is how it happens in a normal game, and the referee responding in the moment. And you put it in a situation where everyone in the stadium sees a replay of it and hears the discussion of whether it should be a foul or not, and is allowed a voice, very much allowed a voice in that process while the referee is actually having to come to a final decision. It sounds great in principle, the idea of you let them know, you have complete openness, you let them know everything going on. But again, the repercussions of doing it will lead to controversy, and they will lead to other problems. The system, there is no
it's fatally flawed, exactly, and you're right, it always has been. I agree with what you say with regards to, you know, how that would cause a whole different set of problems, which in itself suggests that, well, the whole thing was a bad idea. Maybe the solution is simply this: whenever the VAR are reviewing a decision, we just actually play Valerie, the song, in the stadium at the time. Everyone knows where they are. They give a little jig about to Amy Winehouse or whoever, and then when the decision comes through, everyone feels happy again anyway.
I think it should be the Steve Winwood version if we're going to do that.
Okay, Stevie Winwood's fine by me. Duncan, quiz question for you now. Quiz question for all of you listeners as well. I'm going to read you a series of seasons, and then I'm going to ask you what they all have in common with regards to this season. So bear with me for the numbers, but it's worth getting to the end. Are you ready? Here we go. 92, 93, 93, 94, 94, 95, 95, 96, 96, 97, 97, 98, 98, 99, 99, 2000. 2001, 2002, 03, 04, 04, 05, 06, 08, 09, 10, 11, 13, 14, 14, 15, 15, 16, 16, 17, and 2017 to 18. What do all of those seasons have in common with comparison to Manchester United's season so far? Duncan, I'm going to put it to you. Do you have the answer?
Well, I already know the answer, so
because you're omnipotent, of course you know the answer.
All of those seasons, Manchester United were awarded less penalties in the entire season than they have been awarded so far in this season, and we're not even into November.
Well. If ever there was a conspiracy theory that wanted to have justification in the facts, there you have it. Why, Duncan? I mean, what's going on? Is this VAR as well? Because I think we do have had more penalty decisions this season in the Premier League than any other stage in this season in the last 27 years.
Well, look, World Cup...
VAR was certainly... VAR was responsible for both penalty decisions in the game against Norwich City, wasn't it?
Yeah, so you've got two there and one that even Manchester United's manager recognises was wrong. We know that VAR produces penalty decisions. Last World Cup, first World Cup was VAR, massively increased number of penalty decisions compared to previous World Cups. So there's definitely that element. I think there is an element in the way Manchester United play. So as we know, Solskjaer's moved to this fast forward counter-attacking system, very much put his emphasis on that. So he's got Rashford up front, he's got Anthony Martial up front, he's got Daniel James up front. So he's got three players who are quick and who, when the system works, are likely to get in behind defenders who are likely to therefore foul them. So I think they are set up to play in a way that will produce more penalties. So there's definitely an element in that. They've got Daniel James, who has been demonstrated and has already been booked, I think, on multiple occasions for simulation this season. So he's a player who does have a tendency to go to ground and has won penalties, including at least one that his own manager says shouldn't have been awarded. Some people argue that one of the problems with VAR is it gives referees a second chance to benefit the bigger teams. And I haven't seen a proper statistical analysis of that yet, but I'd be fascinated to see it. And the theory is certainly a credible one. Again, you've got that advantage that referees have for the home team, which is scientifically demonstrated. It's pretty clear that you get a bias towards bigger teams in general with refereeing. So therefore, the addition of VAR should help those bigger teams. And we've got a very notable example in the Champions League this season when Club Brugge were 2-0 up against Real Madrid and Sergio Ramos scored from an offside position, which the linesman flag had gone up, which, you know, linesmen are told to keep their flags down if it's marginal. And that goal was reinstated by VAR, even when the video evidence shown by VAR as supposed proof that he was onside seemed to indicate that he was still offside. So you've got an example of VAR apparently favouring a far more prestigious club in that situation. So
I think we should point out, Duncan, that the example of Carrow Road on Sunday did not advantage Manchester United in any way because the penalties were so rubbish.
it's true. As Solskjaer said, Marcus Rashford did the honourable thing by missing the penalty because he felt it was incorrectly awarded. A nice bit of humour from Solskjaer there.
Cheeky Norwegian that he is.
Let's look, factor all this huge number of penalties that Manchester United have been awarded in this season, and let's ignore the argument over whether that they're being favoured or not. You can still bring it back to the facts that Solskjaer, despite all these penalties, has 3 wins in 15 Premier League games, and his team have only scored more than 2 goals in the game twice in the last 20 matches. And that's with what must be a record number of penalties this early in Manchester United season.
Incredible it is. And, of course, news as well that Paul Pogba, once described as Manchester United's talisman, I think for about 2 weeks, will be out until December. And it seems, Duncan, that little break he had in Dubai on his bike with his personal trainer hasn't really seemed to have done the trick.
Doesn't. I mean, this is from Solskjaer himself saying that he doesn't expect Pogba to be back until December. And I think the most notable thing about this is we've talked a lot about how Solskjaer had said that having a proper pre-season with his training methods would make the team more robust and make them able to play better football. And what's resulted is a rash of soft tissue injuries. I think the total now is at 12 players who have 12 first team players who've suffered injuries already at some point during this season. But in Pogba's case, he was brought back from the ankle injury he is now expected to be out with until December to play a League Cup game against Rochdale and aggravated the injury and is now in a position where he is going to be unavailable for most of the rest of the year. Now, that to me is rank bad management. If you have a player who is not fully recovered from an ankle injury and you put him into a game which is of very marginal importance, I mean, if you look at the side that Solskjaer fielded against Rochdale, he had a lot of academy graduates, a lot of inexperienced players in that side. He made Axel Tuanzebe the captain ahead of Pogba in that match. I think Tuanzebe was playing his seventh game, first team game for Manchester United. Incredibly inexperienced to be given that role. Yet he was prepared to risk a player who he regards as his most creative and most important player in midfield. That's just a bad managerial decision, and it's one that he and the team are paying the cost of at present and are likely to continue paying the cost of through the series of games. So I calculate if he comes back for the first game in December, he will miss 12 matches. As a result of that decision to play him against Rochdale in the League Cup.
Well, only time will tell if Solskjaer is made to regret that decision, given Pogba regardless of inconsistency of form, is obviously a very, very talented player and someone Manchester United could certainly be doing with during this run of results, which they are enjoying or not enjoying. It's Monday's podcast, which means it's time for heroes and villains. I'm going to give you my villain of the piece for the weekend, and Duncan is going to go for hero because he doesn't normally get to pick the hero. And when he does, he normally picks an anti-hero. Fairly obvious choice for this one, people. Granit Xhaka, a man whose first name probably told Arsenal everything about what they need to know about his lack of mobility. And certainly he's not as hard as that particular igneous rock either, as he showed when being substituted in the 2-2 draw with Crystal Palace. He was booed by the crowd. He then jeered sarcastically back, cupped his ear, told them, the supporters, as in his own supporters, where they should go in no uncertain terms, and then took his shirt off and went straight down the tunnel. I don't care about, you know, sympathy for this and that and the other thing. I just think that as a football player, being handsomely paid by your club and being supported by your fans, that's no way to behave, especially as you're the captain. So, Granit Xhaka, you're my villain of the week. Duncan, I invite you to tell us your hero of the last few days.
My hero of the week, for the first time, is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Music to the man's ears.
Well, he doesn't, as he said after the match at Norwich City, he doesn't listen to what the media are saying, doesn't pay attention to it. So I think you'll be bothered, but I very much respect the fact that he went on record to say the penalty his team got should not have been given. And good sort of criticism of VAR there. He said, I don't think it's a penalty because when it takes 2 minutes to make the decision, it's not clear and obvious. So for me, it's the wrong one. And then he made that quite good joke about Marcus Rashford doing the honourable thing. So he definitely deserves a Hero of the Week award. He might not have much time to get many more of them. So let's give him this one.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we will pop the audio file into your email as soon as it's ready. Because that's one for your mantelpiece along with your several donkeys that you already have. This has been Monday's Transfer Window podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. We invite you for Wednesday's podcast to, of course, submit your questions for Duncan and I, who will be very happy to answer them as best we can. It could be about Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City, anything you like. Any subject is not one that we will not be happy to discuss, as long, of course, it's both legal and clean. As far as today is concerned, we've been very, very pleased to have your company. We hope you've enjoyed it. And of course, please continue to engage us in the debate and join the debate as well. Tell your mates to come join the debate. We are available at Transfer Podcast, at Duncan Castles and at Garbo SJ. As ever, if you're enjoying what you hear, please log on to iTunes, give us a 5-star review. It gets bigger, it gets better, and that's only good for all of us. For me and from Duncan, until Wednesday, we will see you through the transfer window. Thanks for listening.